This is part three of my conversation with Anne Diamond, discussing Leonard Cohen, MKUltra, social engineering.
From what I know, because I found a photograph, now I say it's him, you know, I have no doubt that it's him in 1951, so he'd have been 17, an undergraduate at McGill, probably in, you know, in first year, and in a Donald Hebb, Dr. Donald Hebb was a neuroscientist at McGill, and he, in 1951, began doing experiments in sensory isolation. And so there's a photograph that someone sent me that I believe it's Cohen. It says it was a Donald Hebb experiment from 1951, and there's a man, you know, kind of trussed up in this sensory out and this isolation gear, you know, blindfolded, with his arms wrapped up and on splints or something, so they can't move them and they can't feel anything. And that, you know, and since he actually told me in about 1980 that he was in flotation tanks on LSD, that was another of the, you know, that was just another part of the same experiment where the flotation tanks, because they were sensory isolation experiments too. So I suspect McGill was very important in terms of being a kind of a control center, you know, and the British influence there and British eugenics and a long tradition of British eugenics at McGill. And I suspect that there's an elite, you know, aspect to it. And I have a feeling that as an early trainee or whatever, you know, volunteer, whatever he was, he had a certain status and knew more than, you know, definitely more. You see, then they would get in. Then what happened in MKUltra was after they'd experimented on adults or, you know, whoever they could get who would volunteer, adults, consenting, you know, guinea pigs. But they found that they couldn't wipe their minds completely clear with their different electroshock and sensory isolation and drugs and all the hypnosis, all the things they tried. They then decided somewhere in the early 50s that children were the ideal subjects.
So I found this quote, which I don't know if you know, I mean, it's on Wikipedia. Leonard Cohen, "I don't consider myself a civilian, I consider myself a soldier."
Yeah.
Which he apparently gave as an explanation for why he ended his concerts, I don't know during what period or if he still does, with a salute.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. For sure.
That's pretty blatant.
Pretty blatant.
Uh-huh.
But nobody got it. You know, what would we have thought of that? He was just trying to instill some discipline into our generation and give us a, you know, like his generation lived through the war. We were just spoiled brats of the 60s, you know, and he's trying to provide a moral, you know.
Compass.
You know, inject some moral fiber into music or something, and using the military as a metaphor.
Right.
I don't think anyone thought he was actually a soldier, but I do think he was. I think he was a soldier of fortune. I mean, I think that's what his first career was. He was a soldier of fortune. He was, yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, again, so it's the metaphor, hidden inside the metaphor, and the metaphor makes it the opposite of what you think it is. So a spiritual soldier, a warrior, you know, that seems like a really a positive thing. But, I mean, it can be interpreted as an entirely positive thing, spiritual discipline and all the rest of it. But there is this, I mean, even without digging into the, you know, the backstory, the secret life, Cohen's secret life, there's this public record stuff of him performing for the Israel troops during the Arab-Israeli war, and his being quite vocal about being pro-Israeli or Israel, right?
I saw it written that he joined the Israeli army. He joined the IDF in 1972. He actually enlisted in the IDF, and he was at El Arish for the Yom Kippur War in a trench.
Okay.
I've heard that, and he told me that I was in Israel, and you know, I just passed through El Arish, so that's why I know that, you know, and I'd seen all these Egyptian soldiers who were partly metal, you know, there's kind of guards, border guards who were kind of put together, they'd been wounded and etc. And so that was very vivid in my mind in 1980 when I met him in Tel Aviv, and I told him that, so yeah, El Arish, you know. And and then if you read, I mean, he writes about being in the trenches as the shots are being traded or whatever, you know, there were missiles or I don't know what they were shooting, mortars, you know. And he has a line, I will test the sphincters of my courage or something. Something I forget, you know. And, 74. But I guess, yeah, he actually, there's photos of him with Ariel Sharon and Moshe Dayan on the internet. I have one on my blog.
Who are they?
Ariel Sharon was the head of the IDF, and you know, the butcher of Shatila is one of his nicknames. He was behind the massacre of the Lebanese refugee camps. I'm not, that's not my area of it, but in 1982, right? And Moshe Dayan, I guess, was the Israeli foreign minister or something in the original, you know, in the original government of who? I'm getting a bit Ben Gurion in that era, if you know the Israeli, you know. So Moshe Dayan was a hero of the Israeli, you know, independence struggle. And I think he'd maybe been in the Warsaw Ghetto too. So, you know, would have been in his 50s or so in the 70s, yeah. And anyway, there's photos of him and Leonard and Ariel Sharon. These are hardline military generals, you know?
Right. So that's pretty conclusive then. I mean, if he's claiming to be a soldier and not his primary career is a soldier and not a musician, and he's actually, I mean, these historical facts are, you know, available,
and
then
you can't get around them.
Yeah,
but everyone does. That's what it's very interesting to talk to you. You don't have
this. Well, it is. I'm a bit of a loss for words, because how do you kind of flatten this out into something that? Because it's. I mean, if he'd been a musician who was also a pro-Israeli fighter, that would be quite romantic, and you could see how potentially. I mean, the public could accept that, but it wasn't like that. It's. I mean,
what was it? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, that when he said he was a soldier on stage, people smiled and thought, ah, Leonard, and isn't that great? He's really committed to his spiritual beliefs, or however they interpreted it, but they certainly didn't think of Israel or, you know, the butcher of Lebanese prisoners or whatever else implications are.
Well, he definitely toned it down in the 80s, I think. He didn't. You know, he was getting into his 50s later, and it wasn't so. He didn't look so glamorous in khaki. You know, like he would. I mean, he'd practically wear a uniform on stage when I saw him in 1975. But he was just 40, and he very, you know, very trim and handsome. You know, relatively handsome. You know, and he, yeah, I remember he. This is in 1975. Yeah, he saluted and. He sang a song. His band was called The Army, the backup group. Sang a song called Come On Down to the War.
But don't you think that most people, who, if you ask them about Leonard Cohen's, not necessarily his politics, because that's a bit specific, but his personality and his beliefs, they would say that he was a very peace-loving, gentle soul who would be against war or violence. Don't you think most people have that general impression of Leonard Cohen?
I think most people do. I don't know how they maintain that, but they don't want to. They don't want to look too deeply. They really want to be lulled to sleep. You know, they want a lullaby. You know that's a part of my generation. You know, they just want to, float off on a cloud of peace and love and all that, and he has definitely, he has a, he reaches them. He can masquerade. Not exactly as one of them, but he does connect with them, you know. And it's just so contrary to what he's actually done. But, mm-hmm. you know, you can forgive him because he doesn't make he keeps it fairly secret, you know. It's fairly compartmentalized. I mean, he has people, I think he has people who've always known him. He's very pro-Israel to the point of, you know, ready to fight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Totally in favor of the you know, the regime that we have now and so on. I think there's always been people who've known that, but there's also the part of his audience that's apolitical and they don't, you know, they don't really care.
Sure.
You know? And
yeah, well, I certainly didn't know that he was pro-Israel. I mean, I'd missed all those signs, but I think we're talking about something much larger here, which is, again, the Jimmy Savile thing and how glamour magic works and how hard it is to really understand it, even when you start to see how it's done. It's still kind of hard to understand how it actually works, that part of the concealment is in actually revealing.
Yeah, definitely. And just shock, and the shock value, you know, the at a concert. Well, and, you know, and then I'm thinking of the concert he gave in 1970 in the south of France where the Maoists shot at him. Did you hear that?
They
hear
shot
that?
At him?
Yeah, they came armed and they took a couple of pot shots at the stage. And later he said, they're real tough critics, those Maoists. You know? He has his self-deprecating humor. He's very quick, you know, and he dismisses. He never reacts. He's so cool, you know. So when that happened, I mean, he did take off. That's another story we might get into, but we don't have to. But 1970 and that part of his career where he really dazzled European audiences, and that was the beginning of his real great success in Europe in 1970 in the summer, spring and summer, when he was touring France and Germany and so on, and suddenly he just took off. I mean,
right.
Then he went to the Isle of Wight, you know, where a film was shot around that and so on. But in the south of France, where things were politically, you know, kind of intense, it was, you know, 1970, yeah, he had a little run-in with the Maoists. Then he disappeared for a while, and that's a whole interesting story, but anyway. But ends up on the Isle of Wight, and then a few weeks later, Jimi Hendrix dies after they'd shared the stage pretty much at the Isle of Wight. So there's a whole, you know, there's all sorts of interesting things. Then 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, after that, Janis Joplin dies.
Mm-hmm.
And Cohen is drafted. I think I'm getting ahead of us now, but I don't want to go there. There is a story there I could tell you, though. Cohen became a kind of representative of conservative values to radical youth in America.
At what point did he become the spokesman that you say?
Right after the death of Hendrix and Joplin. And the concert at the Isle of Wight. So, okay, concert at the Isle of Wight was August 31st or 1970. The south of France, mid-August, I think, 1970. That's where there were shots fired. He rode onto the stage on a white stallion in Avignon or someplace like that.
Yeah.
And anyway, and then he disappeared for a couple of weeks, resurfaced at, and I have my theories, but, you know, things were going on. I'm going to write about it. Then he surfaced at the Isle of Wight concert, which was early September, you know, 1st of September or the end of last day of August. Then 2 weeks later, Jimi Hendrix dies.
Mm-hmm.
Then he's in Tennessee recording Songs of Love and Hate, Tennessee. Then, October 6th, Janis Joplin dies.
Was she in Tennessee?
No, she was in a hotel in L.A. It called, I forget now, but a motel, staying in a motel, and she overdosed. But
right. Because you're juxtaposing Lenin's movements with these mysterious deaths. So of course that's
okay. So let's just leave it at that for now.
Yeah.
But we could. I don't know if I want to really go there, but But we could talk about it some other time, maybe. But the thing is, if you want to know, the first version of Chelsea Hotel has a long sequence about Tennessee in it, but I can't. Anyway, Chelsea Hotel is about Janis Joplin and her death, but I know you can't make sense of that. But so let's just move on.
Okay.
15th of October, around the 15th of October, he plays a concert on a military base in Canada, Kingston, Ontario. 17th of October, I see him for the first time. I've put this timeline together. On the streets of Montreal, the night that Pierre Laporte is murdered by the Front de Libération du Québec, the terrorist cell, murders the Labour Minister of Quebec and starts the move towards martial law. You know, the War Measures Act is declared. This is, you know, Canadian history. Okay. A week, end of October, he's in Madison, Wisconsin, where he opens his concert singing, I think, Solidarity Forever, where you've got this, that's where some kids have just blown up a university building. And there's a kind of, there's incredible tension, there's a huge anti-war movement on campus, there's growing, you know, like, radicalism, and the Weathermen, you know, the violent factions, SDS and all that, are getting bigger and bigger. And he is invited, but I think also sent to Madison to tell them about the events in Quebec and how the military, if things get out of hand, can be on your street, you know, on your campus in a matter of hours, and everything can be crushed. And he gets them all on his side, and he sings Solidarity Forever, and he sings Joan of Arc for the first time, and he dedicates it to Janis Joplin. And he gets this radical, ultra-left kind of crowd on campus to completely, they're in the palm of his hand. And to this day, I read people writing about that. He basically delivered a message to them, you know, to calm down. And they did. Mm-hmm. And he had done the same thing at the Isle of Wight, because when Jimi Hendrix performed, someone set fire to the stage during one of his solos or whatever, and the person called up right afterwards to calm down the audience was Leonard Cohen, and he delivered a whole, I don't know how long, 45 minute concert or something, it's on a DVD, and he had them all sedated, hypnotized, and Kris Kristofferson said, we've never seen anything like that, Leonard is our boy, you wouldn't believe how he, you know, calmed down that audience, they were ready to riot. It was apparently very unpleasant being there in the rain or something, and they were getting very restless. So, you know, and so he developed a reputation, and he'd be sent places, like in Madison, Wisconsin was one. Later, San Francisco, you know. So he started playing this role where he could get the sympathy of the left crowd, you know, the revolutionary students, and he could also deliver a, you know, a message of discipline, and I think that's part of, you know, shape up, you know, and they, you know, they liked him for it.
He was a pacifier.
He was a pacifier, but it was very, very political.
So, but didn't you say that he was actually pushing a more conservative agenda?
Absolutely.
So, besides...
The position being, you know, I've been there, I have those sentiments, I love to see the people, you know, overthrow their rulers, but it's not going to happen, kids. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know what you're... You know, you don't know where where this is taking you. Then he'd bring up Soviet Russia. He was very... You know, very anti-communist, in fact, and he Russia was the most evil country on the planet, as far as he was concerned. You know, because it was communist. And,
really?
Yeah. Well, then I said to him, "Well, they invented. What about the novels? He said, oh yeah, they invented the novel, you know. Buy some truck, coppering round, the dog needs something to eat. Old Nip Berry in a Cadillac hearse down a Birmingham street. Spoon man's here and the folk man's here, snake charm in between. Five fellow freaks in a Cadillac hearse down a Birmingham street. Alabama chicken, show me the way. Alabama chicken got something to say. Look them in the eye, bird don't lie. Alabama chicken. On a wall, and the pot got a scary face. Old Nip Berry spinning his wheel on a Birmingham day. Bottle top gum and a horse head with rust. A bird done lost its beak. Blow your horn for a green dinosaur on a Birmingham street. Alabama chicken, show me the way. Alabama chicken got something to say. Look him in the eye, bird don't lie. Alabama chicken, voodoo.
I propose that I tell you some of the things I found out about Cohen's past, his timeline through Wikipedia, and you can interject at any time because I'm sure you'll have things to say about some of this stuff. But I thought it'd be useful to try and, as we did with your own life last time, to try and create a more or less coherent picture of Cohen's official story.
Good.
And unofficial.
Yeah.
So we've got So we've got his family background, which on Wikipedia says that it was middle class, but somewhere else he was referred to as, I mean, that, there seems to be some confusion about that right off the bat, like whether he came from aristocracy or just this Jewish middle class family.
What do you mean by middle class? I mean, you know, maybe if you mean bourgeoisie, you know. But I think, I mean, they were factory owners. You know, they were the owners. I mean, as far as I understand it, clothing business. But the father died, so then you know, and when he was 8 years old, so he wasn't about to take over the family business. And I think some uncles kind of helped out, but essentially that wiped out the, you know, in a way wiped out the status that they had. And I can't remember. I've seen the house where he grew up on. It was Belmont Avenue in Westmount, which is the top of Montreal, and it is the elite, you know, neighborhood. And it's, you know, he said I grew up. He told me our house is, you know, modest middle class house. Well, not by my standards, but you know, it's not a grandiose. It's not a castle. It's a, you know.
I think it's quite common in two things. One, that you said that aristocracies can fall on hard times. That happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And the other is that in the changing sort of political climate, aristocracies become closet aristocracies. And I'm realizing that about my own family background, that really it was kind of a closet aristocracy. And I, you know, we identified as a middle class. I didn't, because I knew. I mean, I wanted to identify as upper class as a kid, so I'd been instilled with those values, but of course they were socialists, so it was kind of embarrassing to be to be self-identified as upper class. So I think there's those two factors there. But with Cohen, there seems to be, well, there is indisputable evidence that he was from an aristocratic lineage or something. I mean, there's the religious thing. Okay, so he was the daughter of the Talmudic writer Rabbi Solomon Kolinsky Klein of Lithuanian Jewish ancestry. His paternal grandfather was Lyon Cohen, founding president of the Canadian Jewish Congress. Okay, so that's pretty elitist.
Absolutely.
Background.
And there's the right uncle. Away. I think there's an uncle. It'll come. Phillips, Lazarus Phillips. I think he's an uncle of the law firm Phillips Weinberg. And anyway, it's a major law firm in Montreal. And he's a very elite figure. Now, I have to check the actual, I think it's an uncle, but he ties in there, you know. Yeah, it's the Montreal Jewish elite, there's no doubt about it. But, I mean, his brand, as I say, because the father died and he was in the military, I don't know, I'm not sure what that means. I'd like to know, you know, more about that. Yeah, they lost some status there.
Right.
And or at least money, you know, I don't know about. So I guess that was a challenge, you know, and it was the war. You know, the war did impoverish people.
Sure.
You know, it left people, it created chaos, and his generation, so by the late 50s, you know, he's in his 20s. Wait, by 1954, he's 20. So by the late 50s, I think the story was, when are you moving out of home, you know? He's 26, still living with his mother, you know.
Well, so there's some confusion there, but I don't want to jump ahead. I'll go back to timeline and we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
So then we've got the descendant of Aaron the High Priest. He admitted or claimed that in 1967, so that was right when his first album came out. Mm-hmm. If that's significant or not, I don't know. But the fact that he made that claim public, I think, is significant. And then, okay, so he went to Rosalind Elementary School, 48. He was involved with student council. He got interested in Lorca the poet. Mm-hmm. Learned guitar as a teenager. Had a folk group called the Buckskin Boys. And then it says how he frequented Saint Laurent Boulevard and ate at places like the Main Deli Steakhouse. Do you know that place?
Well, I don't think it's there anymore, but it was what was called the Lower Main, Lower Boulevard, St. Lawrence Boulevard, below St. Catherine Street, and it was the red light district, and it was, you know, pinball parlors and strippers, strip clubs, hot dog places, movie theaters. I think there's something called the System Theater that was down there. This is a little before my time, but I knew people that kind of gravitated down there. And even into the 70s, it was a kind of a scene, you know,
right.
People hung out, and I don't know what they did, really. I mean,
well, according to Cohen, he hung out and watched gangsters and pimps.
Yeah.
So that
prostitution
seemed kind of interesting. I mean, think of Jimmy Savile's background, like he was hanging out with gangsters and pimps, and it seemed, until later, it didn't seem that significant, but later it turned out that he was one of them, right?
Yeah.
So just the fact that he was gravitating in those circles at a very, very young age. I mean, talking like, it doesn't have a date, but it must be around 15 or something.
Okay, yeah, that's very possible, because it would be something a young Jewish boy would do, you know, in those days, and even now, they would go down and, you know, slum and whatever, you know. But on the other, you have to also remember that many of those businesses and strip clubs, etc., were run by the Jewish mafia. So he may even have had relatives running some of those businesses, because Montreal was a very, they used to say, I mean, had a huge red light district, and the clubs were run mainly by the Jews, you know. In the wild 40s, there was a big jazz scene too. There was a lot of it was kind of an exciting, fun place to be. But nowhere else in Canada was, you know. And so you could come and watch strippers and listen to very good jazz, you know.
Right. So now we're up to when he left home, because according to you, he's saying he was still living with his mother at 20, but according
26 is what I heard.
Oh,
heard
well,
what
crikey.
I remember.
According to this wiki entry, he, after moving out of Westmount, which was the school, but anyway, Cohen purchased a place in the previous working class neighborhood of Montreal's Little Portugal on Saint Laurent Boulevard.
That would be around 1972. That would be later. From what I know of that purchase, but you know, I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that was something he did. in the 70s. So he married Suzanne, maybe even, she was maybe expecting the first child, Adam. He was born in 72. I think the properties were bought to give them a base, you know, cute little cottage for, you know, and some other buildings in that neighborhood, and they must have gone for $10,000 or $15,000 each in those days.
Okay. Well, it's confusing then, because they've made it seem as though that came right after his school days or before. Because the next thing is 1951, although it is a different section. It goes to poetry and novels, and then it says 1951, Cohen enrolled at McGill University, where he became president of the McGill Debating Union. He talks about this in Ladies and Gentlemen, Man and Cohen, you know, just how kind of prestigious he was at school, you know, how kind of high status he was as a school kid, college kid. He won Chester McNaughton Literary Competition for Poems. And he first published his poems in a magazine in 1954, so he would have been 20 when he first published. His influences were Yeats, Henry Miller, and Lorca again, who he named his daughter after, I guess. Letters Compare Mythologies came out in 56 when he was 22. I actually used to have a copy of that. It was reviewed by Northrop Frye, who's a very famous Canadian critic. So that couldn't have hurt.
And McGill Poetry Series, he was part of that. I think that was maybe one of the first books, if not the first. Or anyway, the McGill, I don't know, it was a big success for the McGill Poetry Series in the 50s.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Then he went back to McGill for a law year, and then he went to Columbia University for a year. Spice Box of Earth was published in 61, so he would have been 27 by that time. McClellan and Stewart published it, so he was with a big publisher by that time. And then it says he got money from his father's death, so that
father's death,
well, that doesn't make sense, because he was nine.
I heard it was a grandmother. I mean, I've heard it more than once, was that it was, you know, a grandmother left her left him something, a small amount, enough to buy that house on Hydra.
Right.
You know, $1,000, something like that.
So that would have been a separate thing. What it says here is his father's will provided him with a modest trust income sufficient to allow him to pursue his literary ambitions for the time.
I've never heard that before, but it's possible. I'm not a, you know... I'm not 100% expert on him, but I've always wondered about that house on Hydra and where he got the money, because I think I have another idea in mind about where that money came from.
Well, it's kind of why I'm lingering on the money, because of course if somebody's an asset, then they do have a mysterious source of income, and they've got to come up with, you know, convenient explanations for it, and it does seem like his kind of financial system does, or situation does seem a bit murky, and it does seem a bit inconsistent, the stories, at first pass, anyway. Like in the documentary, Ladies and Gentlemen, it talks about how his poetry book was a bestseller, which would seem to justify why they were making a documentary about him. But then late in 67, he apparently... The reason that he decided to become a musician was he was disappointed with his lack of success as a writer. So those two facts contradict each other.
A poetry bestseller somewhere in Canada would be 300 copies.
Well, I know. It's like, what does that mean anyway, right?
Yeah, it's ridiculous that people, you know, people are naive. I mean, people who haven't actually tried to live as writers, you know, think there's money in it. I'll tell you, he did quote a figure one time. To me, because I was trying to write a novel, and you know, and he said, if you write a novel, women's novels really sell these days, you know, you can make $1 million. He said, oh, great, you know. And I said, well, did you ever make money? How much did you make off Beautiful Losers? He said, oh, I only made 20,000 on that. And so...
20,000? Well, that was a lot back then.
That was a lot back then, but when you think about... It's not that much, you know. Oh, well, 64.
I don't know.
I mean,
Are you
I
kidding?
now it seems
That
again
would
it
have
seems like
been
a lot of money to make on a book.
even today, that seems like a lot of money to me. And so back then, that would have been worth 10 times as much. That would have been like
Yes,
200 grand or something.
but the time when he, well, this was in the 70s or early 80s when he said that,
Yeah.
people were getting $500,000 advances for books in
Well,
the
some
a little bit
people.
later. Some people, it was
Not
possible
many.
to
Yeah.
get, publishing became a big, anyway, he thought that was peanuts. And you don't know, I'm not sure over how many years also, because that book came out in more than one edition. He didn't think writing, was a way to make money, and he made, made it clear, but he thought that it was something that other people might try to make money at. Anyway.
Well, let's linger on this a little bit then, because obviously his transition from a poet slash novelist to a musician was a key one, because that's what he became. That's how he became the legend that he is today. Now, in the documentary, I always have to think about the name. It's such a
Ladies and
forgettable name. Ladies and
gentlemen,
gentlemen, Leonard Cohen.
Mr. Leonard Cohen.
Right. He you see him playing guitar a bit, so there's a bit of a hint. Okay, he's also a musician. Go back 5 years in the Life magazine pictures of him on Hydra, where he moved, I guess, in 1959. He's also holding a guitar, right? So he was already being presented as a musician
In
to some
1959.
degree. Way back,
But
yeah.
I don't think he'd written any songs. I mean, he may have written a song or two at that point, but I don't think he was really writing songs. But don't forget the Buckskin Boys, That was when he was in high school, and they sang socialist songs, like Solidarity Forever and cowboy songs, and that was a repertoire kind of for the for the time, when a lot of I guess a lot of kind of lefty type people who were singing folk songs in the 50s, and he kind of became part of that, but he was never much of a lefty. So,
Right.
but he does sing some folk
Although
songs.
he was associated a lot with leftist causes and even leftist, apparently leftist players. I mean, significantly so. Like John Hammond's, I'm kind of jumping ahead now. John H. Hammond II was his producer on his first album, or signed, gave him the contract for his first album at Columbia Records. John H. Hammond, I guess was he discovered Bob Dylan and Aretha Franklin and signed Bruce Springsteen. It's a really heavy hitter. But he was also a civil rights activist, and he was a son of a Vanderbilt.
Oh, right. Well, there you go. I didn't know
So that, yeah,
that
right.
part.
Well, that wasn't a big leap. That was just one click away, really, from Cohen's page to the Vanderbilts, 2 clicks. And of course, it reminds me a lot, or it echoes a lot, what I discovered around my own family was, and I think the Vanderbilt, or a Vanderbilt rather, is even on that map that I made of my family connections. I didn't have time to look, but
Okay,
in
that must
terms of how quickly I was able to trace these seemingly civil rights, leftist movements, activism, etc., to
big money.
high power elite, big money factions.
Well,
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's the same. I mean, same all around. I mean, Judy Collins. I mean, I just but let's not go there because we don't want to talk about Illuminati. But that's Collins family. Are considered the what is it, the 13, the
Right,
13
the power
bloodlines.
families.
Sorry?
The power families.
We're tracing his his footsteps, and you say, oh, the
Yes.
good guitar playing. We got it. We're talking about the there he is playing a guitar in Hydra. But he'd always been kind of a, he liked to go to parties and sing and have people sing, and that was one of the roles he played. He probably played that role in high school,
Right.
when he was part of the Buckskin. It was like, let's sing out, strum, strum, and holler, and and learn all the revolutionary songs, and sit around the campfire at the. He worked at a as a camp counselor, in a in a camp north of Montreal, one summer as a teenager, and so that was a very typical thing to do, and everyone had guitars then, and everyone would pull out their guitar. I mean, maybe 1959 is a little early, but, you know.
Right, and not everyone ended up when the photo spread in Life magazine.
Right.
I don't recall the last time we spoke. You said it's my fault. I still don't believe you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. We both know this was a mistake. I'd love to come on, but I need an escape. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Fade out. This is where the credits roll on. Trees and brighter than starlight. I never feel magic unless I'm with you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Tell me you mean it when you tell me you love me. I wanna believe you. I wanna believe you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Fade out. This is where the credits roll on me. I don't recall the last time we spoke. You said it's my fault. I still don't believe you. Oh, 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 Arkansas. Credits roll our name.
I mean, one of the things that how I approach this, I mean, not entirely consciously, it's just inevitable, is juxtaposing my own experience. So I mean, I want to look at Leonard Cohen. I'm trying to figure out, you know, how much help did he get? Was he being backed by some hidden hand, as he himself kind of acknowledged on various occasions? And so, yeah, how easy, how smooth was his ascent to the position of success that he has, and compared to my own complete and utter frustrated attempts throughout the last, what am I, 48 now? So that's pretty much 30 years that I've been trying to get noticed, that I've been trying to have a bestseller, try this, that, what have you. Not that I'm, you know, just entirely driven by a crass desire for fame, success, or endless attention, but there is a desire to reach an audience. And yeah, I've tried everything besides compromising what I do, because it stops being fun. I mean, I'm not able to do that. And basically, I've had doors not even slammed in my face everywhere I went. They didn't even open. It's just like knocking on a door, and like in a dream, and there's no sound, and my fist makes no sound. What's going on? You know, it must be a dream kind of thing. It's like nothing. It's like I don't even exist most of the time, in terms of actually trying to pierce the membrane between the margins and the mainstream and get some sort of endorsement. And I mean, I have had various individuals who've praised what I've done, like Pauline Kael.
Right.
And so for somebody else, maybe that would have been enough. But anyway, I mean, I don't want to make this like a complaint or something like that, but just as a point of comparison, because I think people, unless they've actually attempted to be an artist, be a writer, what have you, to have some kind of social impact, they are quite naive and uninformed about just how hard it really is, and so they don't necessarily see anything unusual in somebody's journey from anonymity to fame.
Right.
So,
Whereas
yeah.
someone who's actually worked in that field and knows, knows a bit about how it works, yeah, we look at it a little differently, and we know that it's a real leap to get there. I mean, he might have had just the most mesmerizing and charismatic personality anyone had ever seen, and they just, everyone just fell for him. And the minute he walked in the door, people went, "Wow," And there is something about him that does that. I don't know how much of that is, just through habit. He's had so much acclaim that, he just keeps collecting more, or that, his fame, just convinces people that he's fascinating and interesting. But I think there's more to it than that. I think he has a deep kind of charisma that it's, well, or a mystery about him or something, qualities that get people's attention. I mean, I think you have to give him that. There's that.
Well, that of course is a question in itself. Like, where does that charisma come from? I
I
mean, I was
know.
watching that documentary again today just to try and find a particular clip, and I did find that I had to will myself to keep moving on and not just because I got very quickly
Why?
transfixed by
Oh,
him. No, not bored.
transfixed.
Just like his manner, his very odd way of speaking, and when he smiles, he puts his teeth together like on top of each other, and very tense, like a lockjaw kind of smile, and kind of a bit autistic, and something just really off about him, but in a very pleasing way to me at least, and obviously to many other people. And I mean, I've explored this and theorized, but I haven't certainly come up with anything really solid. But that trauma, the possibility that being traumatized in a particular way, in a controlled way, perhaps, or in a deliberate way, can create a persona that has this kind of mesmeric charisma. And perhaps it has to do with a resonance, because everyone else who's been traumatized recognizes something, somebody who's been traumatized and been able to forge a kind of identity through that trauma that is effective, that really works, and that in itself is mesmerizing, because it's like, I want that. I want to be able to turn my trauma into a currency,
Well, obviously, many are called, a few are chosen. There's many
Right.
people were traumatized. Not everyone managed to get an audience, and mesmerize an audience. You mentioned that documentary where he's just delivering these one-liners, and everyone just laughs right along, and it's not really that funny. But I think I was thinking about that, and I was thinking exactly what you just said, that there's this odd, like you say, autistic. There's an oddity, oddness about the way he delivers, the way he uses language, which is if, it's as if he's kind of invented it himself, and I think people were
Yeah.
just fascinated. No one speaks like that. It wasn't as though it wasn't a and it wasn't a 19th century kind of, like, I'm sure Lawrence Durrell was very articulate and could, they say he was fascinating to listen to, but in a flowing kind of way. But with Leonard, it's a halting, really off-center kind of, like you say, there's a sense of something traumatic. And I think people were fascinated by that. And I think they either disliked him, or they really identified with him and sympathized with him.
Yeah, well, I think also the context is really essential, because somebody could have that manner and even that charisma, but in the wrong context, if they were just in a bar and all alone, it would be off-putting because it's anomalous. But if you create the context, like in
Yeah,
that
an audience.
documentary, he had these huge audiences. I mean, you're talking about a bestseller being 300 copies. I'm sure that's true, but his audiences were like 300 people. So where did those people come from, But once they're there, anyway, I mean, I've experienced this with spiritual teachers. If you have enough people there who are invested in believing in that teacher, then that power gets transferred to the teacher. It creates an entirely different context. And so what's anomalous, instead of becoming off-putting, becomes mesmerizing.
Yes, and I think the audience was, I think it's a combination of his, he got backing. Irving Layton, I think, had the ability to, his two mentors were Irving Layton and and Louis Dudek at McGill. And I think they had the ability to deliver an audience to him to some extent. It wouldn't have been a big audience, but it would have been, he would have gotten a respectful, treatment from the literary establishment, and then, given these readings. And then once he had that type of seal, that of approval, then people would come to the readings because it would, be advertised at McGill, and, students would come. Yeah. It didn't stop there. I mean, as I say, the NFB, to do a film, it's the same thing. Life magazine doing a photo spread, in 1960. And then in 60, I guess 65 or 66 was when the film came out that you watched, Ladies mm-hmm. and Gentlemen, Mr. Leonard Cohen, right? For them to decide to build a whole documentary around it, he was beginning to be known, but he wasn't, I don't know that he'd yet been on television. I think that launched him and turned him into a television phenomenon too. I mean, he appeared on some shows, and I remember seeing him as a 15-year-old, on This uh-huh. Hour is 7 Days. And, I remember seeing him sing the Stranger Song and, the first time. And it was on this weekly news and public affairs show, And uh-huh. that, it takes contacts. It takes people behind you. And I think in Canada, well, the NFB, but as I said, the NFB was a very particular type of body. There's a lot to the NFB that you could dig up. Right. Did I go into sure. that last time? Yeah. So, military propaganda during the war. And then in the 50s, they were looking for their mission. They didn't know what to do. It was peacetime, and they had been a war propaganda agency, and newsreel. Newsreel films and that kind of thing. And there was a faction that was military that wanted to use the NFB, National Film Board of Canada, right, as an organ of domestic psychological warfare. Basically, they defined they were going to try to mind control the population of Canada. It was about, and they were hardliners, And then you had this left-wing faction that wanted to promote social change, make documentaries promoting social change, and they somehow combined, and I think they were doing a bit of both all along, and they really promoted LSD, excuse me, but right. The NFB made one film after another about kids on drugs, as if, for my generation it was like, well, this is what you're supposed to be doing now, you are alienated and you've got to start taking drugs, that's what kids are doing. Really, it was one after another. I could list a bunch of them. And one of them was the Ernie Game, in which Cohen appeared.
I just looked that up. It's very obscure now, but it won all kinds of prizes.
Yeah.
And Cohen was billed third billing, so he was very central to it. And it was, I guess you mentioned this part, that it was about somebody coming out of a mental institution.
Yeah, who in the end commits suicide.
Hmm.
And it's, to me, looking at that now, I see a program, mm-hmm. I see that's how you, it wasn't enough that they were, they had all these people they were experimenting on, in the 50s and 60s, but then they began making films that spread it, it's a way to kind of further the whole agenda, yeah. right? Make films about it. Under a veil of, it's fiction, or it's countercultural, or it's,
Okay, so let's go back to timeline then. I got Parasites of Heaven. That was the name of one of his books that really stood out, poetry books. That was after Beautiful Losers, which I definitely did read. Uh-huh. There was some controversy around Beautiful Losers because of the sexual content, which yeah. I think is interesting, and that no doubt helped raise his profile.
Yeah.
Well, that was his last ditch attempt, in retrospect, then, to be a writer.
Yeah, a lot of work.
Because it was right after, tell me about it. It's right after that he said, that's it, I'm not having enough success, I'm going to be a folk singer, or yeah. whatever, however he described himself at that time. And so that was what he did, and right after that he apparently went and hung out with Warhol and the Factory crowd.
Okay, what
so
years?
That would have been,
In the late 60s?
I guess this was 66, 67, because it had been this about the time that his first album came out. So, and this was when he met Hammond. I'll go back to Hammond because he's kind of an interesting parallel case, I think, because apart from everything I said already, he was a child prodigy. He began playing music at the age of four. And he was interested in social reform even as a child, which is pretty unusual, I would have thought. And he was in the military in World War II. After that.
You know, I'm very mixed up. I heard John Hammond, I think it's John Hammond Jr., and I saw him perform in Montreal, and he was maybe 30, and that would have been in 1968 or so. Is that...
John H. Hammond the second, so that would be Junior, yeah. That would be the same guy. I'm pretty sure he's
good looking, yeah.
I don't know what he looks like, but he wore many hats, apparently.
Many hats, yeah.
He was investigated by the FBI, which I think is kind of an interesting subtopic there, which is, I mean, my sense of this is that a lot of what the CIA, and not just the CIA, but anyway, that kind of wing of intelligence, the darker, more Machiavellian wing, a lot of what they were getting up to and a lot of their operatives were completely undisclosed to the FBI. So I think the FBI was frequently investigating the CIA's activities and operatives without knowing it, was my sense.
So you mean you could be a CIA operative and be investigated by the FBI?
Yeah, and they wouldn't find out that you were a CIA operative because CIA would... I'm just guessing now because I keep finding this, like, the first sort of flag is, oh, this guy looks like he was a double agent, you know, a musician or what have you, social reformer, but with CIA connections. And then the next thing I find out is that next thing I find out is that the FBI was investigating him, which of course gives him credibility in retrospect. Anyway, looking back historically, oh, look, that he was even such a threat as an activist that he was being investigated by the FBI. You know?
Makes me think of John Lennon and Yoko Ono too.
Sure, yeah.
You know, always on a list for an FBI list, but not so sure about that Yoko. You know?
Yeah, no doubt. So the next thing is Pump Up the Volume, which I thought was interesting. I just showed that movie to my niece actually because I knew she would love it, and she did. And because what it said on Wiki was that Pump Up the Volume brought Cohen to a younger audience, and of course you mentioned Alan Moyle was possibly involved in the MK Ultra things.
I have no doubt I went out with Alan Moyle.
Oh really?
I met him in 1972 in Montreal, and I overheard all kinds of conversation. Well, he was a friend of the late Kenneth Hertz, right? Well, that's how, you know, I met Alan, and then I met Ken, and you know, they were shooting a movie called The Rubber Gun, and I went down on, you know, the set. Alan Moyle and Frank Vitale were shooting a movie called The Rubber Gun, and I was watching one day on the set, you know, and blah blah, you know, it was at that time. But Alan would, I would over listen to conversations that Alan had with Ken Hertz, and the references. I mean, I just remember because it was so peculiar, you know, talking about, you know, different kinds of drugs they were taking and some kind of thing they were part of that was like an experiment. And Alan would say to me, and there's a lot of people who are not going to make it, you know, and it's about drugs, and it's about, it had to do with McGill. And you know, if you look at it, you know, the first movie they made was about pedophiles at McGill.
Really?
You know, you sort of, someday I'm going to just sit down and really view all that stuff. Yeah. But I mean, I do, but there's a lot, you know. So they were building careers around this kind of, I think these people were offered careers if they would cooperate in some way with the program. And there was some sadistic violence. See, what put me off, I didn't go out very long with Alan, although I like him and I think he's a really good guy. I think he's a really sweet, good person, but he was on the fringes of stuff that was sadistic. And there was a story how they took a friend of theirs to a cabin up in the Laurentians, and they held her prisoner and said they were going to kill her, just to see, just to kind of record her reactions. Mm-hmm. And this is back in about 1970. You know, I mean, that's the kind of, occasionally that kind of talk, you know, would surface, and mm-hmm. I would, you know, I want, you know, I didn't want to know people who were doing things like that. You know, I'd be shocked and so on. But they had, as if they were living kind of double, you know, triple lives. They had a lot of things going on, and definitely McGill came up, and some expectation that had been placed on them, and some standard they were supposed to meet, and it was not a moral, you know, it was more about being amoral. Mm-hmm. And I would just pick up on these conversations, you know, that went on in a very rapid, you know, in a very rapid pace. They would just, blah, 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 they'd be talking.
So just to be clear, when you're talking about the conversation that you heard about the people being involved in an experiment and yeah. some of them surviving or not surviving, yeah. was he talking about a film project?
Well, the thing is, it could... No, he was talking about something more like an umbrella kind of situation, something from their past that they shared. And Stephen Lack, the actor who was in Scanners, you know, that I was talking about, he was also, he's in a film called, if you want to really kind of, you know, see them all, they're in a film called Montreal, Maine, which was made in 1970, I think. I think I'm right about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 1970. And just shot in that same neighborhood that you were talking about, the pinballs, pinball parlor and parlors and the prostitution and the red lights, you know, and the places where Leonard, where the System Theater, that neighborhood, that block, that's where much of that film was shot, because that was where those people congregated.
Right.
And so in the 70s, I mean, in Leonard's time, it would have been more close to an underworld, you know, kind of loose, you know, it wouldn't have been a famous artistic, you know, scene or anything. But they all had lofts, and then they gradually moved further north away from that district, because that was a pretty rough district. So they kind of got better places, less likely to burn down if you moved up the street, you know.
Okay.
And I'm just describing again that scene in the early 70s in Montreal. Yeah.
So The Rubber Gun, I was just looking at, is that was Moll's first film.
Second.
It says first on, what was his first?
Montreal, Maine was the first.
Oh, that was that one. Yeah, that's not listed on Wikipedia at all, not under Stephen Lack or Moyle.
Good.
So that's significant.
Yeah,
and then
errors.
They erased it, yeah. And The Rubber Gun is about, as you, I think you said, a sociology student at McGill. And Alan Moyle is in it, and he wants to do a paper with the controversial position that drug use has positive effects,
yeah.
using Steve's family as a case study.
Oh,
so that
yeah.
fits quite neatly into the.
It definitely
we were talking
does.
About with the Ernie game.
I couldn't watch it. I thought it was an awful film, and but you know, I had trouble watching anything they did. Montreal, yeah. Maine just made me, you know, made my skin crawl. But I did get, you know, I watched it, but. And it was shown in theaters, you know. It's funny because they even had a retrospective a few years ago in Montreal, and they brought together the people from Montreal, Maine, and they talked about it. You know, it hasn't been completely deleted, but maybe on Wikipedia, you know. I don't
Weird.
Know why that would be. To me, it was a better film than The Rubber Gun, but...
Right.
I don't know.
Okay, so that's an interesting digression.
Sideline,
kind
sorry.
Of spaghetti. Yeah, no, it's good.
But they were big admirers of Cohen. The thing was,
yeah.
and he referred to them, as I heard back then, he called that gang the Hounds. This is just Montreal gossip.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he didn't, well, he didn't think that highly of them. It was, yeah, and I guess they were waiting for recognition, and they were waiting for his, you know, seal of approval to be put on their work, because he was famous.
Right.
You know. And they all went to New York and met Andy Warhols and so on, you know, and in those days. So,
right. Nothing
too exciting there. But anyway, just to say that, you know, they considered themselves to be very, you know, much, I don't know if they were disciples of Leonard Cohen, but they looked up to him, you know.
Hmm. That was the third part of my conversation with Anne Diamond on Leonard Cohen, MKUltra, Cultural Engineering. The fourth and final part is also available. Anne and I will be discussing in more general terms the technology of music, weaponized memes, and what it means to be a Leonard Cohen fan. This is Jason Horsley, The Liminalist, the podcast in between.